ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land, green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of The Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm one of your hosts. I'm Chris Henry, the museum manager out here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And I have a partner in crime with me today. Sitting to my left is senior editor Sam Olson.
Hey, it's good to be here, Chris.
Well, thanks for coming on. It's going to be a great one. We have a great show. We have Lauren behind the curtain here running the panel. And we're really in for a special treat because we have a speaker here. Every third Thursday, generally, we do a speaker series in the museum. And we have someone special here today who's here to be part of the speaker series. So when you're listening to this, he will have already been here. But we encourage you to follow along on that series. And if you can, come on out and enjoy it. But with us is a gentleman who flew arguably one of the most iconic aircraft out of the Vietnam conflict. And that is John Larrison, an A-1 Skyraider pilot. John, thank you for being here.
I'm pleased to be here.
Well, so John, one of the stories we always like to get from people is, you know, what first sparked your interest in wanting to fly?
I think it goes back from when I was a very small kid. I can vividly remember watching birds, especially hawks, gliding around in the thermals. And impressed the hell out of me on why I couldn't do that. And someday I wanted to do that. So I was hooked on aviation from the very beginning. And like most, a lot of small kids, model airplanes, hand launched. I flew I never got to radio control. The old RC on the control line, that's what it is. Around the circle, flew those a while. And I don't know why, it just seemed like the thing to be was to be a pilot was an aeronautical engineer. So I had my education aimed towards that from the very beginning. People have asked, well, how did you make the decision? I never really had a decision to make. It was just I had to do what I had to do to fly airplanes. And it seemed like the easiest thing to do. High school, we had a college preparation. It was a vocational school, which I'm probably the only student there that ever took the college prep course. But the nice thing about it, since it was a vocational school, I could get some shop work and had several shops. So I picked that up and applied to Purdue, was accepted in the aero engineering school. And somehow I got through that. And and I was in Air Force ROTC. Again, hey, that's a way to fly. I'll fly with the Air Force. And everybody had to go to ROTC the first 2 years because it was a land-grant college. I applied for advanced, got it. In those days, if you applied, if you're physically capable, you were going to pilot training. So I was accepted for pilot training. Finished my college degree in the Air Force first senior year, they set up FBOs at several of the colleges at airports and contracted out a screening program for those that are going to pilot training. So I actually earned my private pilot's license in a 172 there at Purdue. And then I wondered what it'd be like to work as an engineer. So the Air Force could not accept all the pilots graduating in June, generally, at the same time. So they gave you the option to pick the quarter you wanted to enter active duty. So Boeing had made me an offer, a flight test engineer in Seattle. So I accepted that and put in for the fourth quarter, which I got. So I was a flight test engineer with Boeing on the B-52s for about 10 months before I entered active duty. Loved that. Actually, I got checked out to fly in the tail turret for a special test when they changed the electronic system to check it out, make it work. And we had an F-86 that used to make passes on me. And I just enjoyed going to work. And then I got active duty, entered Air Force pilot training. In those days, they had the primary and basic course, 6 months of primary, which was contracted out civilian instructors. Malden, Missouri, which is an interesting place. It was during World War II. It's where they trained tow pilots for gliders. Yeah. Anyway, for 6 months, I flew, well, you got about 30 hours in a T-34, then about 80 hours in a T-28. And if you passed all that, you went off to basic training, which was an Air Force base, in the T-33. And I went to Webb in Big Spring, Texas, and got about a little over 100 hours in a T-33. And earned my wings there in 59H, class 59H. I wanted to go to F-86s at Willie, but they canceled the 86 training program about that time. So the only thing I saw that I really liked was being an instructor pilot. So I applied for that, got that, became an IP in T-33s at Vance Air Force Base. And I enjoyed that for almost 2 years. And I guess I did good because when the T-37 came along to replace the old civilian primary, because the old civilian instructors couldn't quite handle the T-37, I was selected and moved over to the T-37, which was not a lot of fun because it didn't have the legs the T-Bird had. But it was, I got to admit, it was a great trainer. Sitting side by side was a hell of a lot better with a student square zero than one sitting in a front cockpit and you can't reach him. My last year there, I was there 5 years, couldn't get out. They moved me to academics. They had a short notice need for somebody to teach engineering, and with my degree, they grabbed me, and I enjoyed that. I learned classroom presentation, and it's paid me well through my career. I can stand up in front of a bunch of people and not get all excited. But anyway, lo and behold, I was first in the command for the next RF-101 that came up. And all of a sudden, I got orders to Vietnam. And because I found out many years later, the problem, the old airplanes they had were flying apart, and the people they were getting weren't, you know, well trained. So they screened guys that had good flying records, and I popped up again. And I went to Vietnam, didn't know exactly what I was going to fly because it was still classified. And I know you're very interested in the early years. I got there in actually in December of 64. And the first A1s arrived in Vietnam in mid-64. So they hadn't been there that long. The Vietnamese were flying them. Most all of them were checked out in the A1 by the Navy. And some of our pilots went to Corpus Christi for checkout. But we originally were, quote, training some pilots. They called it training. They had been to the States, had got their wings flying basically a T-28. Some of them at Randolph Air Force Base. I know one of the Vietnamese pilots still. So we were supposed to check them out in the A-1 and teach them air to ground, which was a task because they only had about 150 hours of a nose wheel aircraft. And A1 was significantly bigger than them. They used to put a couple of seat packs behind them and below them so they could reach the rudder pedals. We laughed about putting wooden blocks on the rudder pedals like you do your kid's bicycle, but never. But anyway, we finally got rid of that. But an interesting point that people don't understand, which I explain square one in my presentations today's, is why we were flying at A1. A two-place prop-driven Korean War. Actually, it started being designed at the end of World War II, but it was a first-line fighter for the Navy during the Korean War. And then it kind of set away. They still use it for special missions, like they hang radars on them. They use them for ECM, use them for other things. And lo and behold, when the Vietnam War was settled with the French, the Geneva Accords prohibited modern weapons. So when we were trying to help the South Vietnamese, we were using A-26s and T-28s, and they were wore out, falling apart. So that's how the A-1, they said, hey, we've got a two-place airplane that's not a jet. We can tell the world we're training pilots. And I went as an advisor. My first 6 months, I was an advisor. I had to carry a Vietnamese airman in the right seat who spoke no English. I spoke no Vietnamese. He was nothing there but a body in case I crashed. And that continued till mid-65 when the U.S. decided, hey, the Russians, the Chinese, they're not playing by the rules either, so we're going to introduce jets. And the F-100s showed up at Benoit, and that was in mid-65. And F-4s and the other aircraft that flew in Vietnam, most all of them flew out of Karat over in Cambodia or Thailand. And so they wanted to move the A-1s out. And after I left in the mid-December of 65, the squadron moved to Udorn because about mid-65, when they first struck the SAM sites, which we sat there and watched them build with U-2s and everything else, and knew it was done. And they lost a lot of airplanes during that first strike. And we had been fragged, they call it, in an order. And it was my flight check, which is the story that I think read and got me up here, the first flight of A-1s to Udorn. And we didn't really know why we were going, but my flight commander said, you go ahead and lead. So we went to Udorn. And the strike was earlier that morning. We were there late. So they put us on strip alert in case they got a radio contact with a downed pilot around Hanoi. And while I was on strip alert, me and my wingman, a Navy A-4 got shot down about 100 miles north of DMZ. They scrambled us off to go pick him up. And we had a little trouble picking him up, just fired our 20 millimeters a few times to keep down any ground fire. But the search rescue out of NKP, which is Nakhon Phanom, Air Force calls it Naked Fanny, if you hear that word, was still flying the old HH-43, which has very short legs. So we're cruising back towards Udorn, and the helicopter couldn't make Udorn, but McNamara, our Secretary of Defense at the time, was there, and they wanted him there for a photo op, which would be a great photo op. But helicopter couldn't make it. So I said, when we went to Udorn, we took four airplanes, six pilots, a crew chief, and an armor, and I still had the parachute and the helmets sitting in our right seat. So he said, hey, we could land at Nakhon Phanom and pick him up and take him home, or back to Udorn. And all they had was a PSP runway, and we said, we can land on that. So we landed, picked him up. My story has a picture of the pilot standing on the wing. All he had was a cut on his forehead, which the flight surgeon patched with a Band-Aid, and we took him back. I still don't know who he was, because when we landed, they jerked him off with McNamara and never got a chance to talk to him. But they took us to intelligence, and three colonels debriefed us, and the first question they asked was, tell us about this airplane you're flying. They had no idea what the A-1 capabilities was. And years later, I found out from people who were in the air staff during that period of time in Washington, the generals did not want the A-1 to get a lot of notoriety because they wanted more jets.
Wow.
Which is typical. And so you don't see a lot of newsreel and stuff on the A-1 like you do the other aircraft and everything. But they wanted to keep us there for search and rescue, naturally. Saigon, after about 3 days, said send them back to Benoit. Within a month after we got back to Benoit, we were sending four airplanes over there, TDY, on a week or 2 week stretch. And then when I rotated in 65, in 66, they moved the whole squadron over there. And that they took that first sortie and figured out what they could do and built it into what now we call the Sandy operations. The A-1s that were there in Thailand flew air-to-ground along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They did FAC missions, and it was very highly classified. They also supported the Army's special forces into Laos to infiltrate them and then help extract them. And I've got stories about that from the guys. They were on a 30-year non-disclosure. Wow. We didn't know anything about it for years.
Wow.
And it's very interesting what they did.
I'm assuming because it was illegal?
Yes, we were not, to this day, the government, I don't think, admits that we were fighting in Laos. We were supporting, Laos was in a civil war. And just like in Vietnam, North Vietnam, it was communist versus democracy. And you've heard about the domino effect. That was one of the things that was driving our decisions at that time. If we let Vietnam fall or Laos fall, then it's going to be the next country and the next country, which I don't know whether that would have happened. It makes sense to me. But that's why we were there to start with. And like I said, the Geneva Convention is why we were flying a prop airplane, which is my favorite airplane. I know somebody's going to ask me that question. It's my favorite airplane. Love it. After I retired, I didn't fly for almost 15 years. And then I got the bug helping a guy build World War I airplanes. And he helped me discover the RV-8, which is my little A1. It cruises at 155 knots, the same the A1 did. And it's a tail dragger. What more could I ask for? And it's fully acrobatic. When I retired, I didn't want to fly a Cessna 172. It's too slow and it doesn't do acrobatic. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. You guys asked me some questions.
That's fantastic.
Well, backing up a little bit, you talked about, your training and then, being a flight instructor in, T-33s and T-37s and modern for the time trainers and jets. And then you go backwards in time, I guess you could say, to a tail dragger, to a, piston engine. How was that transition for you?
That I've been asked that, and I've talked about it. I can't explain. I never had any problem with it. I didn't. A lot of guys had trouble starting the engine, which is kind of tricky. I think it maybe was my aeronautical engineering training. I loved my engine courses, so I understood why engines ran, why they didn't run, and I never had. I knew how to start it, and. It is a little tricky starting. Just another side thing, if you overprimed it and backfired, the crew chief, you had to buy him a case of beer because he had to climb up on the engine, reach down that intake I was telling you about later to make sure you didn't damage the butterfly in the carburetor. So that was always skill. And I've seen crew chiefs stand out there with their fingers in their ears hoping you'd backfire the damn thing so they could get some beer. But anyway. A lot of good stories. Anyway, where were we going with that one?
I mean, was it an easy transition for you?
No, it was for me. The tail wheel. It's a very weak reason, but the T-37, when you flew you talk to guys that fly it on a touch and go. When you brought the engines in, they didn't always come in at the same speed, so it would give you a little bit of a yaw. Nothing severe. Very light. But I was used to using rudders, and most jet pilots fly with their feet on the floor. I'm sorry. You just generally don't need to use hardly any rudders unless you're doing acrobatics. And the A1 rudder was rather ineffective at takeoff and landing speeds. And what would happen, the pilot would, when he added power, the torque takes you off to the left. You add right rudder, fair amount of right rudder. And it's still going left for a little while, and you add a little more right rudder, and then it starts coming back to the right, and it's coming too fast. I got too much rudder in because now it's more effective. So you take some out, maybe you take too much out, and if you're not paying attention, you can end up chasing it. You've heard guys talk about over-controlling ailerons and everything else. You can do the same thing with the rudder. And occasionally somebody would run off the runway. Because they're just zigzagging back and forth. And I credit the T-37. I was used, I used rudders if I needed them. I kept my feet up on them. And the engine, so I didn't have much trouble. Some of the guys ran them off. Also, the torque, there's tremendous torque. One of the things we would demonstrate, and show at cruise altitude, 5,000-6,000 feet cruise, set it up for normal cruise, and just take your throttles and throttle burst them full throttle. Don't touch the flight controls, and it would do a beautiful barrel roll. It would roll right on over. And after I left, we lost a major who did not have a lot of recip time that got some jet wash on final approach, got to rocking around, and slammed the throttles in, and did half a barrel roll and hit upside down off the side of the runway. Mm-hmm. So you had to pay attention to the torque. But rudder was not a problem for me. Of course, that was on takeoff and landing. In flight, it was not a problem. They used to say you could tell an A1 pilot because his right leg's longer than his left leg from holding right rudder all the time. It became a problem on air to ground because we didn't have our gunnery sight was just, I call it Kentucky windage. It was just, you could adjust the vertical adjustment, but it was not range. You had to be wings level and ball in the center because if you were yawing, your pipper on your target was, the bomb wasn't going to go where the pipper was. So you had to, on your first pass, make sure you got your airspeed, the ball in the center, and get it trimmed. And then as you went around for a second pass or anything like that, you didn't touch any of that. You left it the way it was so it would be right for you on the next pass. Manual gun sight. But that's it wasn't really a problem for me. If it was a problem for pilots, it was only takeoff and landing. And I was, for my aeronautical training, crosswinds, I'm a wing low pilot. I know some pilots teach land in a crab or last minute kick it straight. I'm a wing low, and I would talk to my A1 guys, you know, they would want to make a wheel landing. Well, the problem with that was, again, that rudder was not real effective. If you did a wheel landing, you're landing maybe 10 knots hot. Now, once you get the wheels down, you got to slow down. And that's where they get into trouble, getting from landing speed to taxi speed with that rudder. And I say if you do the right airspeed, make a wing low landing, and when you land, you're taxing now.
Oh. Just out of curiosity, when you, most of your missions, were they would you say the bulk of your missions were doing like the CSAR stuff, or was it – what were you doing on most of them?
No, the CSAR was basically after my time. I led that first one that basically showed them the capability of the airplane. It was not an organized CSAR. It was just us in the helicopter. Now on the CSAR – and the A1s out of Vuodorn and Thailand and so forth, they flew all kinds of sorties. They just didn't fly search and rescue. They flew air to ground. They flew those missions, classified missions in Laos. They did a lot of bombs and strikes along the Ho Chi Minh Trail at night, shoot if they could find trucks. There's all kinds of weird things they did on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. But if a pilot went down, all the A1 efforts went towards that search and rescue. They would cancel everything else and go for that. So my missions in South Vietnam were damn near all air to ground, supporting troops, or at night, my slides, I've got a picture of a fort. What they would do to protect the good guys, they had forts, looked just like the cowboy and Indian square fort. Hmm. And the good people would come in there for the night to protect them, and they'd go back and work the fields during the day. Well, the Vietnamese or the Viet Cong or VCs would attack those forts occasionally and want to get in. And we would get scrambled. We kept two airplanes on night alert just for that purpose, night fort defense. And we would fly out, and we could stay with them for four. I've spent 4 hours at night over a fort. We'd drop a couple bombs. VC would withdraw, we'd orbit, they'd attack again, we could drop again, and we'd stay with them. Later, the Puff the Magic Dragon, the C-47 with the gunship, which then became the C-130, those were really effective at that type of work. Hmm. They could orbit that fort all night, and if they were attacking, they could hose down the perimeter around it. Very effective. The F-100s, they could make about one pass and then had to haul ass because they were short on fuel and they'd expended their weapons. It worked out real good there at Benoit in the Delta in the South area. It took us maybe 20 minutes or so to get there. They could be there in 5 or 10 minutes when the 100s got there. They'd get there, make one pass, head home about the time we arrived, and then we'd spend the night there babysitting. Wow. And the troops on the ground loved it because we could stay with them.
How long could you orbit there?
Oh, you could probably stay. I have flown a 6-hour mission, but a 4 hours over a fort would not be uncalled for.
Okay.
Because we were probably within 30 minutes of back at Benoit in South Vietnam.
Okay.
Now, the A-1 was famous for the amount of armament it could carry. What was your standard loadout? Like, what would you be carrying under your wing pylons and stuff?
Normal, the close air support, generally 1 and 2 would carry bombs, and 3 and 4 would carry napalm. And bombs, most of them were 250-pound, or 500, or you'd carry 500-pound. Later, we got a 250, 260, actually, fragmentation bomb, which was like a super big grenade. If you looked at it, it looked like a regular 250-pound bomb, but it had rings around it. What they did, they took about a 1-inch square steel mandrel, heated it up, and wrapped it around a dowel. They pulled out and put an explosive charge in there. So when it detonated, it threw that shrapnel, and they were very, very destructive. In fact, we had to jack our release altitude up about 500 to 1,000 feet because we picked up a couple holes in the bottom of our airplane.
Wow.
And I know one guy, the colonel was upset whenever we would screw up and get hit. One of them did with a piece of that stuff and trying to convince the colonel that it was a ground fire. And he says, it's a square hole, damn it. It's not a ground fire.
So speaking of damage, did you ever have to bring back an airplane that had received combat damage?
No, I don't want to call it luck. I think it was skill. I never picked up a bullet hole, though, my 225 missions.
Wow.
Most of my missions were napalm. I liked that because it was safer. When 1 and 2 was dive bombing an area or a village or along a canal or whatever it was, I was orbiting and checking all the ground reference points. And you drop napalm, supposed to drop from about 300 to 500 feet. You needed at least 100 feet to let the fuse arm. But I would pick out a ground reference point about a mile from the target, and I would drop down treetop level. Head in, when I saw the target, I would climb up to about 100, 200 feet, drop my napalm, scan the horizon, pick a low spot in the tree line, and I always wanted to turn 20 or 30 degrees as soon as I dropped and head back down to treetop level, get out of the target area, and then climb back up. Because I'm sure, hopefully you've shot dove or quail, especially quail. If you've ever pulled on a quail and about the time you squeeze the trigger, that brief instant between when your brain says squeeze and your finger squeezes, the damn quail would drop a wing and drop off 20 or 30 degrees, and you'd fire right behind them. And I was the quail. That was my, I used to tell my dad that. I said, I'm the quail, and I fly like a quail. And that, I think that kept me, because on a dive bomb pass, you're coming in at about at least 45. We were supposed to be 60 degrees, but generally we're about 45 or 50. On the pull-off, you pull off the target, you're going climbing back up. There's not much lead involved. If you're a hunter, he's going straight away from you climbing up, and you don't have the lead like a passing shot. So that's your vulnerable point for picking up ground fire. Generally not on the pass, it was on the recovery. And that's the way I tried to solve it with my napalm runs.
Were most of your napalm runs, what were some of the targets? Were they mostly in the south or?
Yes. Like I said, all my missions were in the south.
Ho Chi Minh Trail, is that kind of what you were looking for?
No, I never made passes on, that all occurred after I rotated when they moved both the 602nd and the 1st Commando Squadron out of Benoit over to Thailand. That's when they started working the trail, which is part of Laos, actually. If you see the map, it's along between between Thailand and South Vietnam. And that was a trucking route. And Mato's source of it at night, because during the daytime, they knew they were a valid target. They would park the trucks under trees, and you couldn't find them during the day. We dropped radio transmitters. They would drop those along the trail that would pick up the noise. And 130s had listening devices in the back they could hear trucks running and so forth and pinpoint where the trucks were so they could hit them at night and other tricky things. A lot of stuff in Vietnam was done on the spot. Somebody come up an idea.
So were many of your targets, were Viet Cong strongholds?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a point I make in South Vietnam. We were always under control of a forward air controller. Now, the forward air controller did carry a Vietnamese who spoke English, knew the area. He was part of the Vietnamese military. And the FACs generally had an area that they worked, and their FAC, they knew what was going on down there. If their VC infiltrating the area, which they would do, going to attack a village or something, they were the ones, the eyes that knew what was going on. They would request airstrikes for tomorrow if they knew where the VC were. And we would get fragmentation orders, we called them, about 1 or 2 in the morning out of Saigon on where to go. And we would have a FAC call sign and an area. And we would go there, meet up with the FAC, and then we were under his control. The World War II stuff where you know, the rogue pilot breaks off and dives down and attacks something, you know, that never happened. We were always we never dropped ordnance unless we were under control. If you had hung bombs, they did have a couple, 3 free strike areas that they knew nobody was at. You could go there and jettison a hung bomb or something. But as far as strikes, we were always under the control of the forward air controllers. And they were good. They worked hard.
So let's talk about forward air controllers for a second. Can you tell you know, folks like what type of airplanes they were flying?
When I was there, they were all the O-1, the Bird Dog. And towards the end, the OV-10 showed up later. And they actually old T-37 and made an AT-37 out of that. Mm. And they did some FAC work. And we were always upset because those were armed. And we said the FACs, a lot of them were unhappy because they couldn't do airstrikes. All they could do is fire a smoke rocket to mark a target for us. In fact, one of my little stories, the FACs, you couldn't find a mayonnaise jar anywhere on a base. A hand grenade just fits in a mayonnaise jar. And you could slip a grenade in the mayonnaise, pull the pin out, and if you know how a hand grenade works, it's the handle. When the handle comes off, and the pin holds the handle down. Handle comes off, the firing pin snaps in. So you could slide it in a mayonnaise jar, pull the pin out, put a lid on it. You could drop it overboard, and when it hit the ground, the glass broke and the grenade went off.
No kidding. Wow.
So just a sideline.
That's
but,
wild.
But yeah, we were under a forward air controller. And the A-1s, like I said, fly missions. Some of them actually flew forward air control missions for the jets in Laos and along the trail.
Wow.
Because, there was some of the 100s, the F-100s, they flew some FAC missions there too. We called them fast FACs, you know. But the A-1, the beauty was we would cruise to and from a target at about 5,000 feet, which kept us out of the fire in South Vietnam of ground fire. You got up north in Laos, you had heavier guns and everything. Some of it was radar control. And strikes, you would release, you'd roll in at least 3,000 feet, roll in, release at about 2,000. You'd bottom out at about 1,000 or so on your pullout, make about a 4G pullout.
Wow.
For dive bombing.
Wow.
Well, Chris, I know we wanted to get into, you know, any stories that John may have. John, is there anything that, you know, any memorable missions or anything that, you know, is, you know, something that comes to mind?
Well, there was one, actually the one that I got my DFC for, Tom Dwelly, which some of your guys may know Tom Dwelly. He flew an unlimited racer at Benoit. He and I flew together a lot for almost 6 months. And he and I both took a lot of pictures. That's all my presentation was shot. Yeah, Tom and I were on a night alert, and an army convoy came under attack about 30 miles north of Benoit. They were transporting, and they came under attack. We were scrambled off to go support them, and they were almost to get overrun when we got there. And we were talking to the ground FAC. We didn't have an air FAC at night. We didn't have a flare ship either, which we generally had if it was a controlled mission. And they wanted us to drop too damn close. And we said, dive bomb, we both had bombs, said, dive bomb is not that damn accurate. We're afraid we'll hit you. And they said, but if you don't, they're going to get us. And so I told Tom, I said, let's level bomb. Let's make a level pass because we may be long or short, but we won't be left or right. And we could see on the ground the fire coming inbound and outbound along this road. So it was like a couple lines down there. So we made a pass, and they said, move it in. And we made about four passes and just kept moving it in. And finally, the VC gave up and went away. Or I don't know, I know we killed some of them, but they were very pleased that we drove them off. But it was interesting during that. And by the way, the A1 had the Navy, bless their heart, they had a master switch right over here on the left. You could turn all your external lights off. So the way we did that, we did a square pattern, almost like a landing pattern. And one of us would call in on a run. We would up at 3,000, drop down, turn and make the pass, turn the lights off, make your pass, climb back up on the downwind leg, turn the lights back on, and then number two would turn his lights out and go in. And Tom, I was watching him when he made a run, I saw these flashes, and it looked a lot like the 4th of July, the sky rockets that just go boom, you know, you get a white flash and a big bang. It looked exactly like that. And I said, Tom, watch when I make my pass. And he said, darn, there's those flashes. Well, when we went to Intel after the meeting, we found out they thanked us for confirming they'd heard stories but couldn't confirm it, that the VC were launching mortars with a timer up just like anti-aircraft.
Wow.
And but anyway, we saved the guys on the ground, made it back to Benoit, did a quick turn, rearmed, took off again, and when we got back, they said, we're okay, we don't need any more. So we did okay. But that was a memorable one.
Wow, and you got the DFC for that?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I don't know, the DFC, it depend on who in your squadron was in charge of writing. It blows my mind now. I see in the news all the time people getting awards from World War II even. It's a squirrely system. It's the U.S. government and the Air Force and the Army. They're no better than the regular government, especially nowadays.
So I have a question I got to ask you. Is you gave me a figure that you figured out, you know, about how much beer a Sky Raider will hold. Can you tell that story?
Oh, we kept eight airplanes deployed up to Quinon, which is about 150 miles north of Benoit. Benoit is about 100 miles north of Saigon. If you looked at a map, it was an army base. They had caribou and helicopters. And we were on the opposite side of the base with our operation. We kept eight airplanes up there. We had munitions and we had ground crews and everything. And you would go up there for a 1 week TDY, and we'd rotate crews every week. But the army kind of took care of us. We ate at their mess hall and so forth, and their little club they had. And damn, they ran out of beer. So we dispatched an A1 back to Benoit, and I can tell you, you can put 52 cases of beer back in that blue room.
Oh, wow.
Behind. Well, we didn't talk about the blue room. That's the dual seat. The Navy used that for several missions. One of them that required that blue room in the back, they had a mission during Korea or later, where they had a radome actually under the aircraft, much like some of them put them on the bigger ones above, under, and they had a radar operators back in that blue room. And the Navy told me they could pick up a submarine that was submerged if he had his periscope sticking up out of the water, you know, 2 or 3 feet, they could pick it up.
Wow.
And also then later, the last squadrons the Navy flew with A1, I think, were ECM birds. They carried ECM pods. And they could have an operator in the back. And I don't know, they had weird. Well, the Navy, when we learned we could carry all kinds of weapons, and they say, including a nuke, we originally said at 155 knots, how in the hell are you going to get away from a nuke weapon? Well, it took us a while to find out, but they kept saying we had their training. They would go out and drop a BOAR, B-O-A-R. And we found out that stood for a big-ass resupply rocket. Well, what they did, they would do a toss bomb, but the bomb had a rocket on it. So when they released it, it wasn't just a gravity. It was the rocket would shoot it out quite a ways. So they could then do an Immelmann and recover back to the carrier. And if we started throwing nukes around, they would say, we go back to the carrier if it's still there.
Wow. Well, we just got to say thank you. Do you have any questions in closing here? I know we're
we're running short on time, but it's been a pleasure hearing all this.
Yeah, this has been amazing. Thank you for...
Well, we'll do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But thank you for coming all this way. We look forward to hearing you tonight as you're listening to this. You'll be speaking tonight here in the museum.
Got some good pictures Friday night.
We're really looking forward to it. To all those who listen, thank you for always giving us great feedback and great comments. We appreciate it. It's our listeners that allow us to keep this podcast going. So continue those in, especially the positive feedback. We like those. We give the negative stuff to Tom. Honestly, though, thank you so much for your support of the Green Dot. We appreciate it. And we will catch you next time when you're cleared to land on the Green Dot.